All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. I'm speaking to you from the borough of Queens in New York City. It is the 22nd day of February, 2023. My guests today are John Rubino, and he is picking up a lot of coverage on Substack, where he's publishing now, and Patrick Highsmith. He's the chairman of Firefox Gold. It's an exciting new gold discovery in Finland, and one I'm getting really excited about and expect to add some more shares to my own portfolio. And I think when you hear what Patrick has to say, you may want to do the same thing. Well, it's up to you, of course. I've titled today's show, The Swiss National Bank Has Dumped FANG Stocks, Should You? Well, the FANG stocks, of course, companies like Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, and more, other big companies too, some 50 big companies, shares of big companies that the Swiss National Bank owned, and now they're running into some trouble. We're gonna find out, hear what John has to say about that. And then, as I say, we'll be talking to Patrick Highsmith in the second segment of today's show. John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, Jay, good to be back.
You know, it's really good to have you. It's always good to have you. So this thing about the Swiss National Bank, I mean, first of all, the Swiss National Bank, they sold, well, they bought all of these stocks, equities, which central banks never did. They never used to do that. I mean, they would just, maybe they'd buy treasuries, but they would, you know, they wouldn't buy equities or risky assets, but increasingly central banks have been doing that. The Swiss National Bank, and I'm not sure, maybe the Japanese, the Bank of Japan has done it as well. But anyway, the news came out just recently that the Swiss National Bank sold 50, some, you know, portions of their 50 top holdings of U.S. equities, and leading to a $132 million Swiss franc loss. Translates into slightly more than that U.S. money, $142 billion. Why do you think, first of all, why did they do that? Why did the Swiss Central Bank go in and buy equities? It seems sort of strange.
Well, it is strange, and it should be considered strange. But the idea has kind of taken hold in the central banking community that it's better to have a really broad-based portfolio of assets that reflect the economy rather than just monetary assets. But that is a terrible idea, because basically what the Swiss did was convert their central bank into a hedge fund. In other words, it makes money when it creates the monetary conditions that make part of their portfolio go up. And that's an incredible moral hazard, you know, because a central bank's main job is to maintain the stability of the currency. In other words, the Swiss franc should be worth 10 years from now what it is today. It shouldn't lose value. And that's the job of the central bank. But now they've got this idea that their job is to turn a profit. Mm. And so they're buying these assets that are affected by monetary policy. So think of the moral hazard that they're creating here. They own these tech stocks, which go up in times of easy money. So that creates an incentive for the central bank to make money easier than it should be if all you're after is price stability. So now you've got these conflicting incentives that can't help but lead to trouble. And that's what's happening with the Swiss central bank now, is they're having to book losses because monetary policy has gotten a little bit tighter around the world. And that has sent the prices of a lot of these big stocks down. And so, you know, the guys running the Swiss Central Bank look stupid because they're reporting losses. They can't possibly like that. So now they've got an incentive to try to do something about that and generate gains next time around. So you don't want your, this is part of a broader trend in which we're converting everything into hedge funds. You know, the big banks, Citibank and Bank of America did not used to be this oriented towards extreme risk, but now they are. You know, they've become gigantic hedge funds, and now central banks and governments are becoming hedge funds, and that's a guarantee of extreme financial instability going forward, which is exactly what we don't want when it comes to central banks and large commercial banks. They should be the stable things in our societies, and instead they're turning into the exact opposite. And so it's a bad thing. What's happening with the Swiss Central Bank is a sign of things to come, only what comes is going to be on a much larger scale than what they're doing today.
Yeah. Well, it's true that even the Fed and some of the other central banks have lost money on the treasuries, and I guess mortgage-backed securities and so forth that are being purchased too, as interest rates have risen. So I guess the next question I would have for you, John, is where do you think interest rates are going? Because, you know, they're really driven by inflation. And the question is, I guess, really, where is inflation going? And, you know, I think there's a lot of wishful thinking out there that we're going to go back to normal and the Fed can start to lower rates and everybody will be happy again. And, you know, the Swiss, even these big central banks can keep on earning money, owning private equities and so, equity, you know, stocks and bonds and things. What are you thinking?
Well, that's what the central banks hope, but I kind of think we're headed for a recession this year, just because so many things are starting to roll in the wrong direction. For instance, a lot of industrial commodity prices are down. The money supply is actually shrinking. M2 never shrinks. If you chart it way back into the 1960s and 70s, it has always gone up, even in hard years. But this year, M2 is shrinking. And you know, you can't do that when you're running a Ponzi scheme, which we are with the global financial system. You take away the spigot full of fresh money coming in, and the system breaks down. So we're kind of doing that. And at the same time, credit card debt in the U.S. is at record levels and soaring from here. I think that the last monthly report of increased credit card debt was a big number. It was a record high increase. And that's the kind of thing that can't go on for very much longer. You know, to the extent that we're taking on record amounts of credit card debt, that means we're carrying balances, which means a lot of people are paying 20, 22, 23% on their debts, which is a recipe for bankruptcy. So
Crazy.
But you add all of that up, and it looks like the economy should slow maybe dramatically this year. And so it could be that that's accompanied by falling inflation, but it'll come at a huge price because with the amount of debts that we've taken on, any recession is an existential threat to the global financial system. So this next recession might be nasty based on a shrinking money supply and extreme consumer debt levels. So we could be into a very dangerous place during the next recession. And yeah, inflation might be very low while that happens, but it won't be a good thing. You know, it won't be like we've succeeded in getting ourselves back to normal. It'll be like, oh my God, we're dropping into an abyss. What are we going to do? And I think that could be the second half of this year's main story.
You know, I'm wondering about something called sticky inflation that the Fed has identified. David Stockman has been talking about sticky inflation. You know, we have issues now, geopolitical issues that come into play in terms of supply, the supply side of the economy. John, you're not quite as old as I am, but I remember very distinctly the 1970s. I was a very young man then, and we had inflation and unemployment and a recession. You know, all of it rolled into one, the same thing, stagflation. Do you think that's something that's possible, that it might make it very difficult for the Fed to lower rates or for inflation to even come down in the midst of slower economic activity?
Well, you know, that's a possibility. I kind of think we'll have a more normal, but possibly very scary recession rather than stagflation going forward, just because, you know, there's liable to be so much debt wiped out via bankruptcy and default in the next downturn that I think that price increases won't be our problem. But then when the central banks of the world respond to that crisis with even easier money, that's when inflation comes back with a vengeance. You know, that's when we're in the 1970s on steroids, where you know, the currencies of the world are losing value at an accelerating rate, and but at the same time, and not enough people are working, and we don't know what to do. Back in the 70s, we actually had something we could do. We were in pretty good financial shape, so we could raise interest rates dramatically to tamp down inflation. And then we came out of it in the 1980s with a reasonably strong economy. This time around, we can't raise interest rates because that will bankrupt innumerable financial entities that have leveraged themselves to the hilt and have to roll their debts over. So you raise interest rates and their debt costs go through the roof. That's what we'll be looking at in the next part of this cycle. And there's no solution for that. That's when we figure out that nobody's going to save us. You know, the central banks of the world cannot save us this time because they don't have the tool that they used last time. And then all hell will break loose. You know, we'll see this phase change in market psychology that is really something we haven't seen in our lifetimes. Finally, something new.
Yeah, and I think it's a longer term issue too, John, because, you know, in the past, we could live beyond our means because the rest of the world, the let's say the net creditor nations, the nations that were selling more than they were consuming, they were, you know, their net export countries had lots of dollars that could swash, you know, could come back and buy U.S. treasuries, so that, you know, we could live beyond our means. But China's walking away from that now. I don't know to what extent Saudi Arabia, which was a buyer of U.S. treasuries for many years, because they would take their dollar profits from their oil sales and buy treasuries. You know, Japan has its own needs for its resources and so forth. So you have to wonder, if we go into a recession, a very significant recession, and people, as you noted, have really gone up, have borrowed up to the hilt of their credit cards, and they're in the position where they can't really, and they're paying huge interest rates on that. You got to think that the government, you know, the government's going to step in and start deficit spending even more. And where are they going to, how are they going to pay for it? And what, you know, as John Hathaway recently wondered, how high do interest rates have to go to clear the market then, if we don't have these other countries that we're used to, you know, sending us their excess earnings, if they stop that? I mean, John, where is this going to go? You're saying the central banks is too big, they can't fix it this time.
Yeah, well, that'll be the question, because if central banks can't do it, who's left? You know, are aliens going to come down and give us some kind of new money? And barring that, there is no fix for this much debt this far into the cycle. Things will just start to spiral out of control. You know, I did a piece a while back on Substack about the death spiral that
Right.
we're kind of in. Yeah. And basically what that is, a place where everybody's leveraged to the hilt, they have to roll over their debts, but governments, because of recent inflation, have been forced to raise interest rates. And that means all the debt that rolls over has to roll over at a higher and higher rate, which leads to higher and higher interest costs, which leads to more borrowing, and so on, until the system just spins out of control. You know, it's a feedback loop that continues to make things worse. Mm-hmm. Until it breaks down in some way. And that's what we're headed for, with no real solution, because we found out in the last couple of years what happens if money is too easy. You get real inflation. You get price increases across the board.
Right.
So we can't go back there. But now we're finding out what happens if you raise interest rates back to historically normal levels, and that is mass bankruptcies on part of corporations and governments. You know, you're going to see governments not be able to cover their bills here pretty soon too. Because, for instance, the U.S., a couple of years ago, our interest costs were $200 or $300 billion.
Right.
Now we're approaching $1 trillion, and is continuing to rise. Every time the U.S. has to roll over its debt, it increases its interest costs. And that causes it to borrow even more, which raises its interest costs even more. So, you know, the U.S., most of Europe and Japan are all in that same boat, and they're all looking at basically a financial death spiral, in which their interest costs soar, their debt soars, and there's no real way out of it, because they can never go back to negative interest rates again. And you'll see probably the central banks try because they might consider it to be the lesser of several horrendous evils.
Right.
But when they do, then that puts all the pressure back on currencies. Currency values will start falling. And we get that final currency crisis before the reset, you know? So all of this stuff is out there waiting to happen. And we're kind of on internet time with it now too. It might happen very quickly. So this might be a 1 to 2 year story, all the stuff I just spelled out there. So, right. You know, get ready for some fun and games in the money markets.
Oh my goodness, John. When I ask you, you know, a little bit about how you're prepared and how you're suggesting investors cope with what's coming, but just like to explore a little bit more the dynamics of what is going on here. You have this debt spiral that turns into a death of currency spiral. And as Alistair McLeod has said, you know, the central banks have a choice. They can defend the currency and let interest rates go to the moon. But as you just pointed out, with all the debt the US government is carrying, never mind the debt that the private sector is carrying, interest rates rise, it just shuts down the economy, essentially. Things can't function because we've lived beyond our means for so long with fiat money. There was no constraints on the amount of money, at least for the United States. It could continue to expand its money supply. It uses its military basically to do what it wants to do. And now it seems as though we've come to the end of the road. And now I do believe that countries, some of our adversary countries, are very much aware of what you're talking about. They're very much aware of the debt spiral and the problem the United States is basically self-inflicting on itself through its irresponsible money, you know, monetary activities. And you can't live beyond your means forever. I mean, I remember in the economics textbooks and, you know, in college, they're trying to say, well, you know, governments don't have to live within their means like families do because they can always print money. No, they can't always print money, or they can print money, but it becomes worthless at some point in time. And so you think that's, we're getting close to that point, you believe?
Economists are among the dumbest people in the world, it seems, you know, because they say things like, you know, debt doesn't matter for governments and they can keep on borrowing money because they can print more money. You know, they don't seem to understand the consequences of those fairly simple actions. Yeah. So we're kind of in that place now where we're finding out that all of these things we thought we could do, we can't do anymore. And I think the interest rate thing, I think we've already tightened as much as we can tighten.
Is that right?
Yeah. Because remember, if the Fed stops tightening and they say, okay, 4.5% is as high as we're going to go on the Fed funds rate. And that leaves the, you know, 10-year treasury at 5%, let's say, and the Fed stops. That doesn't mean tightening is over, because every time somebody's debt has to be rolled over, they have to roll it over at a higher rate. So right. The governments of the world and the corporations of the world see their monetary environment tightening continuously going forward, even after the Fed has stopped.
Yeah.
You could make the case that, you know, with the tightening that's inevitable as all that debt rolls over, we've already tightened on the part of the Fed too much. Because we should be looking ahead at everybody's average interest rate going up by another 2 percentage points or so after the Fed stops tightening.
Yeah.
And that's going to be brutal. You know, look at a corporation, for instance, that borrowed billions of dollars in order to buy its stock back.
Yes.
Because they could borrow at 0%, they figured they had to do something with it, so they bought their stock back. Well, now those debts have to be rolled over, but at 4% or 5% or 6%.
Right, right.
And that means their interest costs go up, their earnings go down, and their stock price gets whacked, even if their business is in pretty good shape. Their cost structure has changed in a really negative way. Companies out there everywhere have that problem now.
Right.
So, and look at the junk bond market. That you and I could do a whole show on just the junk market.
Junk bond, yeah.
It is a nightmare right now. And it's going to get worse as the junk debt that these companies have taken on has to be rolled over. So that's all out there waiting to happen.
Yeah, we have all these zombie companies that have been living on cheap credit. They've had, well, sort of on a financial respirator that's kept mm-hmm. them alive for a number of years. They're really not viable. I mean, this is where the Austrian School of Economics comes in. I mean, one of the points that they make is that, you know, malinvestment. If you don't let the market price capital, then you destroy capital, you destroy capitalism. And I think that's the path that we've been on. And I have to think that, as again, some of these other countries are adversarial nations like Russia and China, maybe Iran, and some of these are really very much aware of what's going on. And they're shying away from wanting to own the dollar. And John, you know, Alistair MacLeod has talked about this thing with Saudi Arabia drawing very close now to China and to the BRICS. Well, and the Chinese have put in place a futures market in oil and a futures market in gold. So it's my understanding that Saudi Arabia can sell their oil to the Chinese for the Chinese, for the yuan, and turn around and take the yuan and buy gold. So they don't have to have a depreciating currency like the dollar. And if what you're saying is true, and if the dollar starts to depreciate its purchasing power ever more rapidly, or if even if it stays at its current, what, 6%, 5%, whatever the inflation rate is now, ultimately, it's a losing asset, right? And you can't replace that oil that's been taken out of the ground. The Saudis have to be looking at it that way, I would think.
Yeah, you know, that is such a big deal, and it's not getting the press that it really deserves. Saudi Arabia, that almost single-handedly created the petrodollar by agreeing to only take dollars in return for oil, they're applying to join a competing currency system. That is a huge deal. And China and Russia, and to an extent India, meanwhile, have been buying gold and silver really aggressively. So they're putting something in place that might end up being a competitor to the dollar for international trade. You know, it won't replace the dollar as a reserve asset anytime soon. But to the extent that it replaces some of the dollars that are used for international reserve assets, those dollars come back here. People will take them and try to buy U.S. assets with them, which will be very inflationary. In other words, it'll make the value of the dollar go down. And, you know, that seems to be out there as a real thing that's going to happen. But it also explains why we've become so much more warlike than usual lately. Because, you know, the U.S. has a history of destroying anybody that threatens dollar hegemony. And that's what they're doing right now. They're seeing a major threat to the dollar, and they're simultaneously picking fights with all the countries that are involved in that. And I don't think that's a coincidence. You know, that's not something that has independent timing. You know, we're doing that in part because we see it as a threat, the BRICS currency union, and we think we still have a chance of breaking those economies and basically taking them off the monetary chessboard and keeping the dollar as the only reserve asset out there that really means anything. I think it's too late. I think we've blown it on an epic scale. And, you know, even if we go through with the military option and basically try to take out Russia and China as global powers, I think the world is recognizing that, you know, that's a possibility. And they're going to gold. You know, they're not buying dollars right now. They're loading up on gold. The world's central banks are now net buyers of gold on a fairly vast scale. You know, one of the highest rates of gold purchases that we've ever seen is happening right now from the world's central banks. And the reason they're doing that is because they want to be safe. You know, they want to be watching the craziness from a safe distance, and gold gives them that.
Yeah. Well, it just seems to me that we're in a position now where, you know, the world is changing so rapidly from a global expansion of commerce and trade to one in which these military, these geopolitical forces are coming together. For the United States, you know, as David Stockman mentioned on my show some weeks ago, a couple of months, well, actually it was about the time that Russia was threatening to go into the Ukraine and Biden was suggesting sanctions. And Stockman said, this is crazy as hell, is the way he put it, because the world economy wasn't meant for segmentation like this. And, you know, we've got to have, you know, we're not structured for this kind of deglobalization now, and sure enough, you know, with supply problems, of course, it started with COVID, but then continued on, even more dramatically, especially since energy is so important in to every form of modern life. And that was really a big deal too. I mean, and still is, I think. So, you know, and the pipeline to provide energy to Germany and all of that that has taken place. It seems to me we're in a different place now, John, than we've been any time in my lifetime that I can remember, because I was born in 47 and everything was starting to really turn out well for America then. You know, we were expanding, we're the leading world industrial power, the leading power in the world. And then, you know, and then things change. That's the way life is. So do you think we're really headed for some, I mean, you were talking about the sort of the delays, the time that it takes for the tight money, monetary policy of the Fed to really start impacting the economy in a very real way. And, you know, you were talking about how debt is going to have to be rolled over into higher interest rates and so forth, and zombie companies are going to fold. And so do you think that we're in for a dramatically lower stock market yet, John?
Well, normally you get a bear market in stocks when you get a recession, because recessions lower corporate earnings. So yeah, you'd expect stocks to just get whacked here pretty soon. And, you know, another problem for stocks is that all of a sudden, dividends on equities are not looking so good, yeah, compared to bank CDs and these things that, you know, people haven't thought about for 10 years. All of a sudden you can get 4.5% on a bank CD.
Yeah.
And if a stock's dividend is 2%, and that sounded good 3 years ago,
yeah,
it doesn't sound good anymore. So there is competition for equities, and that competition is risk-free. So if the world is scary, and you can get twice as much cash flow from a bank CD or a relatively safe intermediate term bond fund or something like that, why would you want to own most equities? Because the world is scary, you know, and equities don't do well in a scary world.
Right.
So I think there's going to be a big capital shift into relatively safe fixed income assets right now. And that's also bad for the stock markets. So you got corporate earnings going down. You've got stocks still relatively overvalued right now. You've got geopolitical insanity happening out there. And let's just leave the aliens out of this for a minute. You know, we're shooting things down and not being able to describe what they are and stuff like that. But you've got a lot of reasons to want to lower your risk if you're pretty much anybody managing money, from a retiree all the way out to a hedge fund. De-risking probably makes a lot of sense, which means sell some equities, take some of that off the table and put it into something safer. So that's bad for stocks. You know, it wouldn't be a surprise to see a bear market in stocks that is 20 or 30 or 40%, depending on what they do with interest rates while the bear market is in place. Oh, and one other thing is that the Fed in the last 20 or 30 years has been really quick to jump in to bail people out.
Yeah.
Which has allowed equities to you know, they call it the Greenspan put, basically. The Fed had your back if you have equities. Now, the central banks of the world are nervous about inflation, so they want to wait longer. They're willing to accept more pain in the financial markets before they start easing again. So maybe, you know, in the past, when they would have stepped right up for a 20% drop in equities and started easing, maybe this time it's 30%. We don't know what their number is, but it's going to be bigger than it has been in past years. So there's a lot of different factors all mitigating against equities right now. And I think that now's a good time to look at crash-proofing your portfolio.
Right, exactly.
Could be wrong, but yeah, you know, but there are things you can do. And, you know, maybe even want to start shorting or something now. Go watch the movie The Big Short. Be inspired by how much money you can make when you get that right. And then come back and look at what's overvalued now. You know, maybe some NASDAQ put options or something like that is a nice piece of insurance to own in a normal portfolio.
Yeah. You know, John, you just wrote an article, Crash Proofing Your Portfolio, on Substack. And just maybe let people know how they can, how do they go to sign up for your Substack publication?
Yeah, so I've got a newsletter on Substack. Right. The address is rubino.substack.com, and it's got basically different categories. You can sign up for free and get most of the content, or you can subscribe. You take out a paying subscription, and then you get stuff like the portfolios that we're building up on there, and more actionable investment advice. Mm-hmm. But you know, come in, sign up for free, see what you think of it, and then we can go from there.
Yeah, in your article, you said there's three different ways, and maybe you just talked to them just now. But take a longer term view, and I guess there you're talking about going to cash and making sure you're not in risky assets now. Wait for the bottom to fall out of the equity market and then go back in and buy things cheap. I mean, yeah. Successful investors do that. It's very hard for most of us to, when everyone else is buying, it's very hard to step aside. And we haven't really seen a what I would call a real crash yet in the equity market, like we've seen in some past situations. Then you say be cautious. Well, maybe you could just review it again. And then you talked about short selling. I think you might have just touched on that. But
yeah,
there are things that you can do, and I guess you cover some of that. You probably talk about some of that in your publication as well, right?
Yes. Yeah. There are lots of things you can do if you're nervous. And see, I think some of the things that you would normally do to protect a portfolio, they're kind of counterintuitive. People don't really think that way. But I think it's easier to think that way now because the world is so objectively terrifying.
Yes.
So if you've got money at risk, it's not a hard sell to get you to raise some cash or something like that. So, you can just sell some things that have done well for a while. And then just hold on to that cash, or put it in, a short-term fixed income thing that yields you more than the dividends on the stocks that you sold.
Yeah.
And you can, if you're buying things, like I'm creating some portfolios of, for instance, junior mining stocks, some of which look really good operationally, like they're finding an awful lot of gold and silver.
Mm-hmm.
And they might be buys even now, but you don't want to just do an at-the-market a buy order, put a low ball offer in, or do something called selling puts, where that allows you to buy in at a lower price if the stock goes down, but it pays you to wait for that to happen. And then you can also buy puts, which are bets that the market or some subset of the market are going to go down. And then you make money if we go back into a bear market. So mm-hmm. there's other things you can do, but those are the things I've written about so far.
Right.
And, adding any of those strategies to a conventional 60-40, 60% stocks, 40% bonds portfolio lowers your risk, mm-hmm. which I think is a very big deal now. You definitely want to take as much risk out of your life and your finances as you possibly can. And those are some strategies that you can use to get you there.
Right. Well, John, do you think there's some kind of companies that can do well in bad markets as well? And I think you implied some of them. The equities that have done extremely well over the last number of years in a low rate interest rate environment are much different. I think what we're probably going to want to do, and I think you'd agree with me, we want to look for companies with strong earnings. If you're going to be invested in equities, you want to look at companies that have strong earnings, low debt, I suppose, is a big plus. Especially if they have to roll it over, cash flow rich companies. I heard just recently, in fact, that the gold shares, three of the big gold mining companies have doubled their free cash flow in the last number of years, and yet the shares haven't gone almost anywhere. On the other hand, the FANGs lost 80% of their free cash flow, and they're only down 35% or something like that recently. So those stocks, you would think. I guess it really depends to a great extent. John, do you think then the interest rates are likely to stick higher longer than most people think? Do you think we're ever going back to a zero interest rate environment again where, you don't have to make money to see your stock fly?
I think they'll try to take us back there, Jay, one last time. And it will just blow up in their faces.
Yeah.
And that'll be the end of this era of history. That will be the point where the history books stop the chapter on the monetary insanity of fiat currencies and then start the next chapter, which is monetary reset back to sound money, et cetera, et cetera. So, central banks only know what they know, and they've only lived through an era of extremely easy money and rapid money creation. So this generation of central bankers is going to pull out the tools that they know how to use until those tools just break in their hands. And I think that's what happens next time around, is that, you know, they go back to 1% or 0% short-term interest rates, and inflation just spikes and currencies just crash. And that's the end. You know, it's over for that toolkit and for the whole concept of fiat currencies. So, you know, it's exciting to live through something like this, because it's taking way too long. But I want to be there with a portfolio of junior gold and silver miners when it happens, you know?
Yeah, that's right. It's taking a long time. And I think it's taking a lot longer than some of us thought it would take for things, for the wheels to fall off the wagon, actually. You know, but I don't like to quote Keynes too much, but I think he was one that suggested that markets can be irrational a lot longer than you expect, or that your money will last, or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's the idea anyway.
And that is the idea, and it's absolutely true. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, John, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us. Any final thought?
Oh, just be careful. You know, that's really my main thought. This is a crazy time when so many things can happen, and they can come from left field and from right in front of you. And from, you know, so just to the extent that it's possible, pay off debt, lower the risk in your financial portfolios, make sure you're indispensable at work, and, you know, involve yourself in your community so that the largest possible number of people have your back. And do all that, which, by the way, is the stuff we should have been doing all along, but now it's definitely time to be doing it.
All right. Well, thank you very much, John. Really great having you. We'll do it again sometime soon, hopefully. And so thank you very much. Well, folks, if you like this video, be sure to hit the like button at the bottom of your screen, and also subscribe to this channel. But don't go away now, because Patrick Highsmith will be right back with me to talk about a very exciting company that I'm really excited about. They're making some new high-grade gold discoveries in Finland. And Patrick will be here to tell you all about that. So don't go away. Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. I'm really pleased to have Patrick Highsmith with me. He's the chairman of Firefox Gold. Firefox is an exciting gold exploration company that's having some pretty exciting success in Finland. And that's why I'm really happy to have him with us today to explain what's going on there. I don't think the market's paying any attention to it, frankly, and they should be. And that's why I'm really glad that he's here. Before I say hello to Patrick, let me tell you, you can buy it in Canada. The stock trades under the symbol FFOX. It's FFOXF in the United States, 138 million shares outstanding, trading at about 9 cents a share, giving it a market cap of roughly 12 million. Yeah, just $12 million in US money, folks. Patrick, thanks for joining me.
Good to be here, Jay. Thanks for having us.
So you had this really some exciting assays that people don't seem to be paying any attention to recently from Mustajärvi, your flagship property in Finland. Talk a little bit about the grades that you've been showing, a little bit about, you know, the orientation in the ground, whatever you can tell us about it. Let's hear about it.
Yeah, Jay, I think people are distracted in today's world, aren't they? And we're out doing our work trying to find hard assets like gold. And Firefox is 100% focused in Finland, as you said. And really, it is a little bit of a complicated exploration story, Jay, because we have such a huge tenement package. It's measured in the hundreds of square kilometers in the central Lapland greenstone belt. This is a new greenstone belt, literally controlled by three juniors and two majors, Jay. So ourselves, large tenement holder, Rupert Resources has discovered a major new deposit there, over 4.5 million ounces and growing. Orion Resources, our neighbor. And then there's Agnico Eagle and B2 Gold, and that's pretty much it. So it's an exciting place to be with such a tight land position, and for Firefox with such a tiny capitalization to be such a big player. Mustajärvi is indeed our flagship project, Jay, and we put some very fresh news out just last week. So that news release does include a lot of graphics because it's a fairly complicated and interesting discovery. And I'm going to share a screen. I'm just going to back up a couple of slides here so that folks can see that and just start here. So Mustajärvi sits in the middle of the Central Lapland Greenstone Belt. Here to the north is Agnico Eagle's Kittilä mine. Historic production and resources there around 9 million ounces, Jay. So it's a big one. Mustajärvi happens to sit on a paved highway between the Kittilä and Sodankylä, the two cities in the Arctic here in Finland. And you can see our other large land positions highlighted in gold. But we put these graphics in the news release, Jay, because we've been drilling here for a couple of years along about 2 kilometers of this big structure where we've been hitting gold, pretty consistently. And we've identified three significant lobes of mineralization that are all shallow. But the east target here on the right-hand side really comes pretty much to surface, Jay. And that was what our announcement was out last week because of the grade and the fact that it is very shallow. And in this view here, since you asked about the latest results, we've zoomed in on the drilling here in this east target. And you see these holes have been drilled on about a 25-meter spaced grid here, Jay. That backdrop is a geophysical anomaly here. The green means go. Green and blue are magnetic lows that typically have hosted the gold in this part of the world. And right in this area, the last two holes we announced were 24 and 25. These came out a week ago. And you can see here on the right-hand side, those intercepts included 13 meters at 15 grams from only 29 meters below surface and 12.5 meters of 14.3 grams from only 14 meters below surface. And just before that, in January, we reported 15 meters at 13 grams from this area right here, only 11 meters below surface, and 7 meters of 16 grams from, again, 22 meters below surface. So this is a nice lobe of surface mineralization. It's still open. We expanded it with hole 24. We've expanded it to the southwest. We've also indicated some good stuff going north here, 170 grams per ton at a little about 70 meters down up here. And hole 25, not only did we reinforce this and cut it at a little bit of depth, we know it's contiguous to depth. We also hit some really nice gold over here, which is underneath where a highway passes through. So amazing growth in this area, compact tonnage here, Jay, because we're racking up these kind of grades over much better widths than we've previously seen on the property. So it's pretty important to see that not only are we hitting grade, but it's still open to the southwest, to the northeast, obviously to the north. That was the first hit up in the north right there, and wide open in this area to the south where we hadn't even drilled anywhere near that before.
No. So you have good expansion potential there, the way it looks, and near surface.
It is. A lot of the stuff previously we reported, Jay, had been narrow and extraordinarily high grade, sometimes in containing visible gold. So we included some photos so people can see what that looks like. But the difference here, Jay, is the rock looks different. It's been replaced by quartz, and this is all pyrite on the bedding in the rock. And that we call that replacement style. So that's a more voluminous, potentially bulk style of mineralization where we can really add things up, Jay. And we do show it in 3 dimensions in the news release as well. This is a long section here. You can see slicing through the earth, just a few meters of sort of glacial sediment, dirt basically here, obscuring the outcrop. And it does come right to surface there. You can see several holes have hit it. It kind of is dipping off to the southwest here, and a little bit to the northeast. And when you look at a cross section, looking a slice through the earth here, this drill hole 24 was in a new area, and you can see we found more near surface, and we see indicating that it continues to depth, still pretty shallow. There's a 50-meter scale bar, so this is still super shallow, but it is continuing to depth. And in hole 25, we see again we're reinforcing the shallow stuff, but down here we're down to a couple hundred meters depth. First drilling ever, no drilling over there. So the computer doesn't know where to draw these shapes yet, Jay, but we think that'll start to hang together as well. So we're super excited about the expansion potential here. And again, at these grades, it doesn't take long for tonnage to add up and for ounces of gold to add up.
Yeah, and if it's near surface, it doesn't take as much drilling either. So another
That's
positive
right.
for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you done any metallurgical work yet on any of this, Patrick?
It's great that you asked that. I'll just go back to this slide. Look, we're just getting ready to put some notice out in the next month or so, maybe around PDAC. We'll put a press release out about our work plan for the year, Jay. But what's unique about this discovery for compared to a lot of resources around the world that and folks that are discoveries people are drilling, we can walk right into ours, Jay, and we're permitted here, and it does allow trenching. And so, given the shallow bits of cover, we expect to cut a few trenches through this zone here in the summer, where we will be able to access this mineralization right from surface and take probably many bulk samples for the first metallurgical work. We have done some microscopy petrography where we look at the rocks under the microscope, Jay. We know the gold is often free gold and also probably associated with telluride minerals. This is sulfide mineralization, but it's associated with pyrite there as well. But we'll do the first metallurgical test work starting this year. And again, that's made easy because this resource comes to surface and we can put our hands on this stuff. So we look forward to cutting a few trenches, sharing some video and photos of that with people as our summer program moves forward. So we look forward to announcing here in the first quarter our work program for the year. But obviously, we have some areas we need to fill in to refine the shape, see where it goes to the south and to the north. So there's certainly expansion drilling capability here, but also we'll be doing a bit of metallurgy.
Yeah, you have some other, a couple of other larger companies that are operating successfully there. Certainly, Agnico Eagle, and I think B2 Gold. Are their properties anywhere near yours?
Our neighbor here to the north of Mustyarvi is B2 Gold. They're mostly working to the east of us about 20 kilometers, but I'm sure they're noticing our drilling on the neighborhood. All the geologists up here know each other, Jay. So yeah, we've chatted to all the companies and in the neighborhood, and everybody knows what we're up to. And there's a couple of discoveries happening in Finland, and we're one of them. But having a neighbor here at B2 Gold, that's great. We own 100% of this property, and we've got some room here to the north before we hit the property boundary. And who knows? We're going to add a little bit to these tenements here at Mustyarvi, but with over this 1.5 kilometers, Jay, from here to here on this slide, we've now drilled 10 holes with more than 90 gram meters of grade thickness. So
Wow,
that means
that's
there's
good.
either narrow high grade or thicker sort of medium grade over a kilometer and a half here multiple times. And just because it comes to surface here at the east target, this is a cross section. There's the east target at surface, northeast a little deeper, central also coming to surface. We've got a lot of work to do in between here, Jay. So I reckon B2 and others will watch us as we progress it on their southern boundary.
So this year, do you expect you're going to be your first priority will be to expand the east target because of its high grades, and then try to fill in between the central zone and the northeast target?
You're doing our geology for us, Jay.
Hardly.
We
A
will
little
be
more
following up,
complicated than that.
obviously. Obviously gold at surface will be following up at East Target. But the cool thing is, Jay, we've learned a lot about this East Target. And we're going to go back and look at each of these other targets with some of that new structural geology information. And we will be returning to drill at both of these in a different direction. But we'll prioritize. As you know, we've got something like 11 projects, six are permitted for drilling. So we will be drilling as we always do on other exploration projects, including Saurabee, right next to Rupert's huge new Ikkari discovery. So we will be returning to Saurabee as well. But clearly, when you're drilling this kind of gold, you're going to make sure to give it more attention.
So yeah, you're in the Lapland Greenstone Belt, which is really underexplored compared to other major greenstone belts, gold-bearing greenstone belts in the world. Why do you think it's taken so long for people to pick up on this one?
Well, as I think I've told you, I first visited in 2003, Lapland Greenstone Belt, and I worked quite a bit there with Newmont between 2005 and 2007. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Finland was a base metal mining country, and until it joined the EU in the late 90s, it was not easy for a company to do work here. You'd have to have a Finnish partner, for instance, and it really opened up in the late 90s and then really opened up when they revised their mining law in 2005, I think it was. And again in 2011. So that really opened the doors. And of course, Agnico seized the day and bought the mine the deposit that would become the Kittila mine. And now really, because the base metal companies held most of the ground, there really wasn't much gold exploration until about 2014 or 15, Jay. And since then, ourselves and Orion and Rupert have gotten in there and pegged big land positions. So we really like it from the sense that the early movers have a really good controlling land position there, Jay. So geologically also, as I mentioned, 98% of this terrain is covered with this glacial deposits, which obscure bedrock. So there's only a few areas in this part of the world where you get outcrop. But at Mustajärvi, we're pretty darn close to outcrop. You just have to put the drill hole down there to get through that that glacial cover.
Right. So Finland is, I guess politically, it's probably a pretty good place to work compared to some other places. Any comments on that?
Yeah, look, I think the Finns do battle every year with Denmark for being the least corrupt country in the world, literally speaking, Jay. It's a fully transparent mineral law. It's a fully transparent legal and judicial system. It's truly a first-tier jurisdiction. Infrastructure, even in the Arctic, we're driving on paved highways, no helicopters needed, a couple of international airports, a World Cup ski hill. In fact, the Finno-Scandian Exploration and Mining Conference is happening at the Levi Ski Resort late this year. That only happens every 2 years. And we'll welcome folks from all over the world there to see it. It's a great place to work. The people are well-trained and well-educated. Literacy rate is extraordinarily high. So a fantastic place to work. And it is a true mining country.
Well, doesn't get much better than that politically, I guess. So you've got a new addition to your team. I understand Alex Davidson, I believe his name is a special advisor. Could you talk about him?
Yeah, we just announced that today, Jay. Alex Davidson, the longtime executive vice president of Barrick Gold for exploration and corporate development, has joined us as a special advisor to the board. Hmm. Jay, Alex is a geologist, but he led several of the big acquisitions at Barrick. He really drove them into Latin America from an exploration point of view and beyond. And he also was really a kind of instrumental in the acquisitions of Placer Dome and Homestake and Lac Minerals and others. Alex has a keen eye, really a unique track record, Jay. And we figure in talking to Alex, he's a shareholder of Firefox. In talking to Alex about what we are doing here, he sees the potential in this emerging belt. And we're having to navigate as this tiny company in this world with some of the big guys and sort of not getting much attention in the capital markets. And who better to come in and advise us given his major company perspective, joined with myself having worked for Newmont, of course, sure. The same time Alex was at Barrick and Rio Tinto and BHP myself. We've got a lot more major company point of view, and that really helps us because at the end of the day, somebody's going to be building a mine, hopefully at Mustajärvi, but there'll definitely be another gold mine being built in Lapland. And who better than Alex to advise and counsel Firefox as we navigate through for both strategically, but technically on our project. So really great to welcome Alex on board. That news release was just out today. And looking forward to getting together with Alex and the team at PDAC in a few weeks.
Yeah. I always like to know who the major shareholders are in the company and also management. Can you talk a little bit about, does management have skin in the game and who else does?
Yeah, at the board level, we have, it's around 10%. Myself, as an individual shareholder, percent and a half or something. But then Magnus Minerals and Carl, that's a private company that Carl is in that had owned these claims initially, are big shareholders at around 10%, 9%, something like that. And then our biggest outside shareholder is Crescat Capital. They're over 10%. SSI out of Zurich is sitting in there at about 9.9%, I believe. And then you can look on our website and our presentation for a few other institutional shareholders that are listed there. We even have a family-owned drilling company in Finland called Kotti Drilling, the best drillers in Finland. They own several percent of the stock, as does Zenito Gold and Silver Fund out of Helsinki.
Oh.
A gold and silver fund based in Finland, of course. So the institutional investor mix is there. The skin in the game from management and the board is there. And those are key ingredients, as you said.
I can't imagine you have too much trouble, given what I see here in this with your results recently. and the upside potential with all the other properties you have there. I can't imagine you'll have a lot of trouble raising money, but it certainly seems you're going to need to probably. How are you cash wise? And gee, as a shareholder, I don't want to see you own, raise too much more money at this level. Not at least not until I load up. So, can you comment on that?
It's a constant struggle, Jay, in the markets we're in, and we're now, fully disclosed to all our drill results from 2022, and all that material information is out there. And of course, we are subject to this market. But it isn't that it's been hard to raise money, Jay. It's that when you have projects of this scale, you'd like to raise more at the right price. And so we're out there meeting with folks, and we're certainly going to have to put more money in the till before this year's drilling program. But the good news is we have a drill available. We expect to be back to Mustyarvi probably in beginning in late March, Jay. We can drill through. You want to drill while the snow is out there, and then it starts to melt in sort of late May, and we pull back from the field for a while. So we've got time. We'll fit a bit more drilling in, but we will be out visiting with folks and looking for opportunities. When with our institutional shareholder base, we have gotten great support every time we've gone to market. But you're absolutely right. We want to get out there and put eyes on this story, let people appreciate the scale of this thing. And we'll see if we can't minimize that dilution by putting most of the money in the till at higher prices. So it's a constant struggle in our space, Jay, as you know, and that's one of the reasons we'll be taking a lot of meetings at PDAC. And of course, we're joining you at the Metals Investors Forum in Toronto right beforehand.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to it. Well, just in summing up here, I guess what should investors be on the lookout for? A potential share price catalyst.
Well, I think getting that news out today will make some folks think. When you see an executive like Alex Davidson join a team like this, he was on the board of Yamana, as you know, which has just been acquired by Pan American and Agnico, and he helped with that transition as well. So when you see a team like that, you see these sort of technical results. The next thing to look for is what are we going to do this year? And that news will be out between now and PDAC. And then we'll get after it with drilling again starting in late March. And as you can see, when you have a look at those maps of Mustyarvi, wouldn't be hard to position a hole, Jay, that's probably going to hit some more gold out there. Every time we drill at Mustyarvi, we hit gold, and we usually hit high grade. So we'll be back there drilling pretty soon. And of course, that's the main thing I think investors are looking for is where's the next big gold discovery coming from?
For sure, we're certainly looking for them, and there are some exciting ones out there. This one is starting to emerge, I think, is one that people are going to want to keep their eyes on. And so I want to thank you very much, Patrick, for bringing this to the attention of our viewers. I think it is an exciting story, and we'll look to keep up with you in the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, folks, that is it for this week. Next week, we're going to have, let's see, who do we have? Bob Moriarty is joining me. That should be very interesting. And Quentin Henning to talk about Irving Resources. Remember, if you like this video, be sure to hit the like button and sign up, subscribe to this channel. Thank you very much for watching. And until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.